was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee waltz when an old friend I happened to see introduced her to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me. I remember the night and the Tennessee waltz. Now I know just how much I have lost. Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee waltz.
And thank you for listening to Women's Magazine. I'm Global Val. You're listening to MutinyRadio.fm. And my guest today is Ollie Mae Trost Welch. Welcome, Ollie.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. So welcome to Women's Magazine. I'm so happy to have you here today. We've known each other for a while, and every time that we get together, it's always a pleasure and a treasure, because you're always sharing some poem that you've recently written, or a song, some sort of insight, for sure. So it's a real pleasure and a treat to have you come in to be our guest on Women's Magazine today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I know we've got a lot to we're going to cover quite a bit today, because can I ask how old you are?
Pardon me?
How old are you, Ollie?
84.
So we're talking about a lifetime of experience, and we're going to get a chance to hear about some of that today when you're going to read bits of your memoir a little bit later. But let's talk first about some of your time in San Francisco.
Yes. I came to San Francisco on my own at age 17. I met my husband here. His family had been San Franciscans for generations. Two of my three sons were born in San Francisco. From their early age, I raised my sons as a single mom and went to college full-time at the same time. I graduated from San Francisco State in English literature and creative writing. It was at State that I met Stephen Gaskin, the original hippie. Stephen, his wife, and young daughter lived with us for a semester while Stephen got his master's degree. Stephen gave many talks at the Family Dog at Ocean Beach, where huge crowds gathered there, before he escorted 60 buses of his followers to Summertown, Tennessee, where they created a commune that exists to this day. Meanwhile, I took my sons to the Beatles' last concert in 1966 at Candlestick Park. Eventually, I worked at Joseph Magnin, where I met Pat Montandon, the socialite. Then I worked at Gump's, where I met Haruko Hagiwara Matsuishi, the granddaughter of Baron Hagiwara, the creator of the Japanese Tea Garden in Golden Gate Park. Haruko remained close friends with me and my family for many years. Now I'll read two poems, a tribute to my mother, Effie Mae Drysdale Trost. Her devotee. Father liked to chop beauty from our sight, but he could only raise trees that he could see. and mother was a forest against a full blue sky. Her quiet growing moved the earth and made the sun her devotee. A house of light. Mother stood tall like a lighthouse, an immovable sentry against a mighty sea. Not on my watch, she seemed to say. With steady sure signals, she breathed light in and out of the darkness. The black impulsive sea, always in mother's face, spraying salt into her eyes and over her white starched skirt. She stands proud, endlessly waving to the cold and cryptic waves. The light she throws out is a knotless net to catch a sailor's watchful eye. Her unwavering guidance, a beacon of trust, a house of light, mother.
Ollie, that's a beautiful poem. Both of those are beautiful poems. I sense that in your life, matriarchy has been a theme for you. Writing poems about your mother being a beacon of light, and then you yourself being a single mom, a single mother here in San Francisco in the 60s, and going to school. How did you manage all that? How did you do all that? What was that like?
I couldn't have done it except that my eldest son was a wonderful role model for his younger brothers, and they were such good children. I cannot remember my youngest son, who was just 16 months old when we divorced, and I can't remember him ever crying. He was so mellow. If they hadn't been good children, I never could have done it.
Certainly. Well, that reflects on you as well. Absolutely.
I felt like I was a natural mom.
Did you always know you wanted to have children?
Yes, I did. Frankly, that was my main reason for getting married.
So an early marriage, three children, and an early divorce, and a lifetime since of experiences and adventures, certainly. So I know you've also written your memoir.
About growing up on the farm.
And where was that farm?
In Everton, Missouri.
Everton, Missouri. Wonderful. So are you going to read us some excerpts from your memoir?
Yes. First, I'll read the editor's introduction where it was published in Springfield Magazine. Olive Mae Tross Welch grew up 30 miles from Springfield on a farm at Everton, where her family shared a two-room dwelling which housed 11 children, even though her mother's paternal grandfather once owned the land now known as New York's Wall Street, before he died fighting in the Civil War. Her story concentrates more on how she and her siblings survived the Great Depression and World War II by overcoming poverty spiritually with laughter and music.
Really woven into American history. I like overcoming poverty spiritually. I'm excited to hear what's coming next.
And now my memoir, Coming of Age in the Ozarks. There's a line from the Bible that goes like this: "The meek shall inherit the earth." Meek was the name of the one-room country school where most of us Tross children attended classes at one time or another. A few years back, I visited that old school and found that it was being used as a barn, piled to the rafters with bales of hay. Now I'll tell you something of the farm where I grew up, a beautiful but impractical little farm of 80 acres in the Ozarks. Father paid $1,500 for it in 1929. The farm was 3 miles from the town of Everton, And Everton's population has always been around 300. The rural communities surrounding our little town was what educated people called WASPs. Growing up, I thought the whole world was Protestant Christian. I was sheltered. The farm was always bursting with beauty, a perfect place for a poet to grow up. One of the things that made it beautiful also made it difficult to cultivate: the endless rocks and caves that seemed to cover the land. A seductive, healthy little creek trickled through our valley. It had no name. The crown jewel of these precious acres was a cold, eternal spring pouring endlessly, spontaneously, out of the hillside, our only source of drinking water. A word about our dwelling place. The house was built of thick cement walls, presumably to keep the interior cool in summer and warm in winter. There was no indoor plumbing or electricity. In winter, we had our supper by the light of a kerosene lamp, and no phone, radio, or newspaper. The only book in our house was my mother's Bible, and we had no clock. There was one door only, and that door never had a key. I have always been both restless and contemplative. As a child, isolated in the Ozarks, where the landscape always changes, yet always stays the same, I knew many seasons, planting and harvesting, wandering in and about the woods, among the little creatures that also changed with the seasons, disappearing and always returning. Osage Indians once ran barefoot over these hills, just as I did. No doubt they drank from the same hillside spring. Once in a great while, I found a precious Indian arrowhead. I had a secluded place deep inside a special cave where I kept my arrowheads. But first, I held them and admired their whiteness, their chiseled strength. I imagined a young Indian boy my same age shaping those very arrowheads. I gave him a name. Instinctively, I called him Dawn, D-A-W-N. While older children helped with the planting of crops in the little valley, I worked alongside Mother planting the vegetable garden beside the house. In addition to a variety of vegetables, Mother always planted a row of old-fashioned flowers. The seeds were purchased from Montgomery Ward catalog. Summers, I remember crickets and fireflies on hot, steamy evenings. Afternoons, later on, I spent in the woods alone, gathering wild greens to help out with meals. I found it was fun and grown up. I remember the steep canyon that led up the creek, where one could wade only in the very middle of the waters, because lush wild growth nearly reached all across from side to side. I remember the cabin there on the lean black bluff, mysterious Harvey's cabin, where a lone man, a professor of botany, lived and studied nature in the summer months. All these things aroused my imagination, for I had much time for reverie. Ike and Ivy Graham and their four children were our nearest neighbors and one of the poorest in the community. Ike received a modest pension from the government, as he had fought in World War I and was injured in some way. They lived in a two-room shack about half a mile up the trail. Ike's government check didn't go very far, but at the top of the list was Ivy's chewing tobacco. She even had a spittoon. Every 4 years in November, the Grahams had us to their cabin to listen to the presidential election returns. for they managed to have a radio, and we didn't. Late into the night, we would leave the Grahams, jubilant or dejected. And I remember on at least one of these occasions, Father carried me home on his shoulders down the dark trail. Games we played, especially during the winter months, were Chinese checkers and paper dolls cut out from the Montgomery Ward catalog. I was a whiz at Chinese checkers, figured out its strategy, and could win every time with my eyes closed. I should mention that Father's ancestors came from Stuttgart, Germany, and were part of the Pennsylvania Dutch colony, German-speaking Amish people. Mother's paternal grandfather came from England, her maternal side from Wales. Some of my earliest memories growing up on the farm were beside my mother, naturally. Among other things, I soon realized that Mother was deeply affected by the sadness in life, yet the smallest thing could make her happy. A new school would begin, a new school year would begin, and my brothers and sisters returned to school. Then I would have Mother all to myself. At this time, I was 3 years old. Our day began with a trip to the hillside spring for water. Our buckets full, it was mostly downhill, but the path led up a little rise where we set down our buckets of water and rested. Mother always sat on one particular rock. It was while we rested there, she taught me songs. Mainly sad songs, some religious songs. It was while I was in my third year that I made my first public appearance singing. The performance was made at Meek School, and the audience filled that one-room schoolhouse. The experience could have been overwhelming, except that I discovered I learned I love to perform.
And I know that you, I've always seen you perform since I've met you. You're always singing. So just a quick question for you. So when you finally left your home and came out to San Francisco, did you perform in San Francisco? Were you a performer and in that community when you came out here?
No, not right away. Amazingly, our one-room country school had a piano, and that piano changed my life. One day when I was in second grade, a visiting music teacher was sent to lead us in singing at the piano. She pointed out to us where middle C was among the piano keys and where middle C was on the sheet music. Thereafter, when the other school children went outside at recess to play, I stayed inside and studied the piano and sheet music. We had no piano at home, so I practiced on a long piece of cardboard where I had marked off the piano keys with a pencil. Mother was so thrilled by my interest in music that she located a used piano for $25 and had it hauled out over the rocky trail to our home. She was so pleased with my progress that she scraped together enough money for me to have classical piano lessons as well as classical voice lessons. Mother even took me to the big city of Springfield, Missouri, just the two of us, to see and hear Jeanette McDonald and Nelson Eddy sing. I was much moved by their performance. I was enthralled by their theme song, The Indian Love Call. Soon I could play the piano well and sang along with my sisters Betty and Dolly for the Southern Baptist Church. Mother often said that she would not have made it through the war without our singing around the piano. It was when I was 13 that Mother had me baptized by the Southern Baptist Church. I remember the pastor leading me into midstream of Jordan River and lowering me backward into the waters. When I emerged from the river, the first thing I felt was embarrassment, for my water-soaked dress was clinging revealingly to my wet body. But soon a sweet spiritual awareness came over me, and I began to feel a kindness toward all things, even to the farm animals. Mother was waiting for me as I waded out onto the shores of Jordan River. My love for her was even greater than ever. I began to appreciate more fully the person of purity she had always been, as was her grandmother who raised her. Mother never learned to drive a car, nor did she have any desire to. Her horse and buggy suited her just fine. When I was approaching my 16th birthday, Mother still drove me into town by horse and buggy. It was downright embarrassing because virtually all our neighboring farmers had by then shiny, brand new, little black pickup trucks. It was soon after my baptizing that I met Philip Wyckoff and made my first romantic attachment. Philip was 4 years older than I and was a gentleman who respected my innocence. I dated Philip for 3 years until I moved away, the only boy I ever dated from Everton. Father was complex, I must tell you, but there's a side of him I want to share. I visited my hometown of Everton a few years back, and the only thing happening on Main Street was two old-timers sitting at a card table on the sidewalk playing checkers. I went over to them and introduced myself. One of them spoke to me and said, "We were just talking about your father, Fred Trost. We were saying that Fred Trost was the hardest working man we ever knew." But Mother always said, if there was a hard way to do a thing, Father would find it. A disaster hit the farm in 1930 that turned Father's life around as a farmer. Farmer Johnson's property was on up the creek, a half mile or so. We knew he had built a dam across the creek, but that had been years ago. The creek continued to trickle down through our valley without much change during those years. One night we heard a roar, but Father said it must be distant thunder. At dawn, he went outside and by instinct took the path down the hill to the valley below. He then knew the worst nightmare had come true. Johnson's dam had burst, flooding our entire bottomland. Our precious topsoil washed away, our crops ruined, totally wiped out. The crops that had been so carefully planted and tended. The flooding, the rush of water, had left the valley strewn with rocks. That day, and that day only, Father was a broken man. After the flooding, he went away and worked for the WPA, Works Projects Administration. He sent money home for groceries, and though our neighbors got food supplements from the government, Father would not allow it. Thereafter, as long as I can remember, Father went away to find work, returning home only occasionally, and left the farming to his children. When Pearl Harbor was bombed, I was 11 years old. I remember those war years that followed quite well. My brothers in uniform, while we girls learned to dance the jitterbug, a product of World War II. All my brothers returned home safely, by the way. Brother Bill, home from service in the Marines, refused to talk about his war experience. But we did know he fought on Okinawa and many other Pacific Island battle sites. That battle of Okinawa lasted 4 months. Brother Decatur, home from the Army, was the opposite. Speaking of his experience, "If you get me started, you can't shut me up," he said. And he would always say, "Bill had it harder than I did. I drove a tank across northern Africa. Then toward the end of the war, I landed in northern Italy. My job was to sit in my tank and guard the general's headquarters. I remember thinking, when we would have a break, all my GI buddies would gather around, drinking whiskey and smoking cigarettes. I would just sit quietly in my tank, eating raisins from a huge box of GI-issued rations." Although Decatur's tank was not physically at the front line of battle, he still got hit in the leg with a piece of shrapnel and was awarded the Purple Heart. Brother Hubert was in the Navy in South America and many other sites around the world. Brother Fred Jr. was with a construction gang in the Aleutian Islands, building airstrips for our airfield. One day, Father came home and announced, "We shall be farmers no more. This farm, the rock pile, will always be ours, but not the farming. Your brother Fred Jr. has offered to share his home in California with us." When Father broke the news, it was still light outdoors. Not surprisingly, his words left me in a sentimental mood. At once, I went to my secret cave stash to fetch the precious arrowheads I had hidden there, but I decided against taking them from their natural home. I thought once again of my fanciful friend, Don, of the Osage Indian tribe, my spiritual brother. "Don," I said, "your spirit shall remain here on the Ozark Plateaus of Southwest Missouri, where your essence lives on." Next, I went to the spring where I knelt and drank its pristine waters for what could be the very last time.
Holly, thank you for sharing some of your early years of your memoir. It's really moving, and I see the connection you have or had to your place of birth and that place where you grew up and the poetry that you bring from it. And one of the things you said was it was a great place for a poet to grow up, right?
Close to nature.
Close to nature. So tell me, if you can, do you remember how you discovered that you were a poet?
I didn't discover it until much later on, when I was in my 70s, actually.
When you were in your 70s. But had you been writing poetry all along, or is that just when you started doing it?
No, I had not.
How very interesting.
Uh-huh. So, although I was a creative writing minor at San Francisco State, but I tried to write fiction and nonfiction.
And so your memoir was published in this magazine, and you've had other publications as well, right?
For my poetry mainly, and a play of mine was performed at Dominican University last fall, for which we received 6 awards. It was based on George Bernard Shaw. You know, he was a lifelong atheist. And in my play, he dies and goes and finds himself in heaven. And they're just 2 characters, Shaw and God.
And I got to hear that play. You read it for us at one point. What was the theater festival for that? I forget the name of that.
It's the Fringe Festival.
The Fringe Festival of Marin.
It started in Scotland, actually. The concept.
So that play won 6 awards.
One act plays.
And what's the name of that play?
Was it my play?
Yes.
It's just called Shaw.
Shaw. It is an interesting conversation between George Bernard Shaw and God. So that won 6 awards. Congratulations.
Shall I sing my song now?
You, please do. Please sing your song.
Memories light the corners of my mind. Misty watercolored memories of the way we were. Scattered pictures of the smiles we left behind. Smiles we gave to one another for the way we were. Can it be that it was all so simple then? Or has time rewritten every line? If we had a chance to do it all again, tell me, would we? Could we? Memories may be beautiful, and yet what's too painful to remember? We simply choose to forget, for it's the laughter we will remember long after we remember the way we were, the way we were.
Ollie Mae Tross Welch, thank you so much for being here today on Women's Magazine and for singing that song. Can you tell us a little bit about why that song means so much to you? I've heard you sing it before. Why is it one of your favorites?
Well, I had a friend who was a professor of creative writing. He passed away recently, and I sang this song at his memorial because he always, when we were out at restaurants, he would say, "We have a singer here tonight, right from New York City." And she's going to sing for us. And I would always sing this song.
Well, thank you for singing it on Women's Magazine and for being here. And I hope this is just the first visit. You're welcome. Please come again. And you came with your couple of your lovely granddaughters here today.
Yes, Whitney and Shannon.
Whitney and Shannon. Thank you all for coming. So one last thing, Ollie. So with all of your life experience, and I think a little bit of that philosophy comes through in that song, what advice do you have for people living in the world today? Maybe for your granddaughters or for other people who...
Seek peace and brotherhood around the world.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. I think that says it all, folks. I'm Global Val. You've been listening to Women's Magazine with octogenarian playwright, poet, singer, Ollie Mae Tross Welch. And we'll go out with a song from the beginning, which was a request from you, Ollie. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.
I was dancing with my darling to the Tennessee waltz when an old friend I happened to see introduced her to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me. I remember the night and the Tennessee waltz. Now I know just how much I have lost. Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee waltz. dancing with my darling to the Tennessee walls when an old friend I happened to see introduced her to my loved one, and while they were dancing, my friend stole my sweetheart from me. I remember the night and the Tennessee walls. Now I know just how much I have lost. Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee.